about that for a minute, because I know that's what he's been doing in some of your lives. I know it's what he's been doing in my life. The thing that you've always been good at, all of a sudden, now you can't do it. You bang your head against the wall, and, you know, you're willing, and now all of a sudden, you're not able. Two ways that God proves to me that his strength is fully developed in my weakness. Two ways. They both involve helplessness, which I hate. One is involuntary helplessness, where God just engineers a circumstance without asking my permission, where he just puts me in a situation where I'm handicapped and I can't fix it, and then he proves that he can. And I don't like that. But I tell you what I like even less is the second way he proves it, and that's voluntary helplessness. When there are 10 things I can do to fix it, and God says, don't you dare. Keep your mitts off of it. Oh, but God, there's 5 things I can do, and he says, don't you dare. You'll ruin everything. Keep your mitts off of that. Let me do it. I wonder why we don't hear more teaching on this, because it's the overarching message of the entire Bible. Some of our favorite stories, this is the message that's embedded in them. I love that story in Exodus 13 and 14. We sang the song from Exodus 14, 14, the Lord will fight for you, you only need to be still. Remember the story. God finally, after picking up where Rick left off, finally Pharaoh gives in and lets the Israelites go. And Aaron and Moses are standing there with their Rand McNallys, you know, trying to plot the course and figuring out where all the Cracker Barrel restaurants are, where they can stop along the way. And they're planning the course, and they're getting it all ready, and this is how, you know, they're going to make a beeline out of town. And God says, no, I don't want you to go that way. And they're saying, but God, look at the map. Look, this is the quickest way. And God says, I don't want you to go that way. I want you to go a different way, and I'll lead you. And many people miss this. I missed it for years. But the way that God purposely led them right into a trap. Did God just not know what he was doing? Should he have looked at the map? Well, no, he was up to something. He led them on a series of decisions in obedience to him that caused them to be trapped at the Red Sea. Red Sea in one end, mountains on both sides, like a bottle canyon. You know, once you're in, there's only one way out. And then God showed Pharaoh where to find them. So Pharaoh and his army are the cork in the bottle. They're trapped. Million plus people. Some of them are close to the water. They don't hear the Egyptian cuss words and the horses snorting and the rattling of the Egyptian swords. They're too far away. But the people standing right there are freaking out and thinking, oh God, you just brought us all the way out here to kill us. We should have gone a different way. And then God speaks to the whole nation and says that most inappropriate thing to human reasoning. Exodus 14, 13 and 14 says, stand still and you will see the salvation that the Lord your God will bring to you today. The Lord will fight for you. You only need to be still. Very next thing that he says is, he says, you know these Egyptians you've been so stinking afraid of for 430 years? You're never going to see them again. And I'm going to show you, and I'm going to show everybody who the living God is. If you follow that story all the way through, and of course we saw the movie, didn't we? So, you know, it's a pretty fabulous thing that God did. He did a thing that defied all the laws of physics, like stopping the sun, or the rotation of the earth, whatever it was that he did. He rolled the Red Sea back. Follow that story farther on down when they got to the Promised Land and they got to Jericho. Right where our tour bus hung a right, and we headed up the hill towards Jerusalem to Abraham's tent, right there where we didn't get to go into Jericho because it's Palestinian held territory, right there. When they came, the spies went into the city. They met a woman named Rahab. In the sanitized versions of the Old Testament, she was an innkeeper. But the word means she was a hoe. She was a prostitute. But when push came to shove and she had an opportunity to back these guys up or to turn them in, she said something very revealing to them. She said, "I believe that your God is the real God." She said, "We all heard about what happened at the Red Sea. We've been shaking in our boots." She said, "I just want you to know, I'm on your side. I'm on your God's side." Here's the other thing. When God engineers a situation where I'm trapped, where I can't fix it, he's not only wanting to show me something, that his power is fully developed in my weakness. He's also wanting to show other people. And we always forget that. We always think it's all about us. And it hardly ever is all about us. It's about other people that are watching, wanting to know if there's anything to this trusting God thing. That's why when I bail myself out and answer my own prayers, who gets the bad name? Well, God does. Because I fixed it. And sometimes I see Christians make the big mistake of saying, "Well, God, you know, God, I just owe it all to God." And they don't, number one, if you don't mean that, it's a lie. If you're giving him credit for something when you didn't trust him and you answered your own prayers, then the whole thing backfires. And the lesson's not learned. The lesson God wants to learn, and he, like I said, he will engineer circumstances like he did with the Israelites, like he did with Paul, where there was a handicap he could have taken away and he said, "No, there's something else more important. What's more important is that you see my strength fully developed in your life, and that's going to require you being weak for a while." Didn't stop God from taking the Israelites to their land. They still got where he was going to take them. And we always have the opportunity of learning the lesson when we're trapped or not learning the lesson. And as my friend Bill would say, the lessons, when I avoid them, just get harder and more embarrassing, and harder and more embarrassing. Better learn it now and let God prove his faithfulness. So that's God-engineered helplessness or involuntary helplessness, where God brings me into a situation. He's done this many times in my life. When I understand what the reason is, I develop the habit of my knee-jerk reaction instead of being to freak out or fix it or scramble. My knee-jerk reaction is to run to the Lord and say, "Empower me, enable me to deal with this now. Whatever it is you want me to do, if you want me to sit here with my hands in my pockets, that'll be hard, but I'll do it if I know that's what you want me to do." But the habit is to go to him first. Are you understanding what I'm saying? And most of it, that isn't our natural reaction. Survival in this planet for most of us meant that we learned to be self-dependent. But it didn't work, did it? Did it protect you? Can you protect yourself from bad stuff? I think Romans 8:28 is a step above that, where it says, "In all things, God is working for the good of those that love him." That means even if bad stuff happened, that means even people use those weapons that they're forging against you, it still won't work. It's still not going to win. So being trapped may be doing a whole bunch of good things. I have noticed, too, from that whole story of the Red Sea, that sometimes that's the way that God gets rid of that perennial enemy that I have, the thing that I fear the most. I know him many times in my life. He said, Bob, we've had conversations where he said, Bob, you know this thing, the worst case scenario that you're so afraid of happening? And I say, yes. And he says, let's do that. And he proves to me that it doesn't matter. I'm still his. He still loves me. He still works in my life. And that's how the fear is conquered. But he may be up to so many more things than that. So this is how he proves that this is all a rabbit trail from be empowered in the Lord and in the power of his might. I need to know what he's able to do. Here's the thing with voluntary helplessness, which is the other way that he proves it to me. I have to admit, I'm not ready for the voluntary helplessness part until I've had some involuntary helplessness. You know what I mean? When I'm in a situation where I can't fix it and God comes through, hopefully I'll learn God's going to come through. And then when he says, okay, son, keep your mitts off of it, then I'll trust him. And I won't try to answer my own prayers. So that's why he does both things. Sometimes there are several ways I can rescue myself, and he says, no, don't do it. What I want you to do is let go. Don't you hate that? That's one of my three least favorite words to hear from God. Two of them, let go. The other one that is my least favorite is wait. I hate both of those. But track with me here. Aren't those the very first two steps of true faith? Of truly trusting in God. The first two steps are let go and now wait for God. Wait for God to do what he's going to do. But it just, like I said, is so foreign to us. Here's the other thing that's twisted about me. Maybe you're this way. I know some of you are. I tend to rely on him completely in the areas that I know that I'm weak. But in areas that I think I'm strong, I don't rely on him at all. So guess what happens? In order for God to show me how foolish that is, he has to let me fail. Biggest example I can think of in my own life is how absolutely implicitly I trusted my own judgment. Most of my life, I was right a lot of the time, but not enough that I should trust myself the way I did. Trusted my own judgment. So you know how God cured me of that? He allowed me to make some really stupid decisions. He allowed me to trust my judgment in ways that I messed things up so badly that they can never be repaired. Now, Romans 8:28 still applies, and he's still working good in my life. But sometimes the good that he works in your life is when you look back and say, well, I'll never do that again. And that's a good thing. So then when we're faced with a situation where I'm going to trust what God says or I'm going to trust my own judgment, he says, okay, son, here we are. Here's your opportunity. And I start heading over there, and he says, no, don't want you to do that. I want you to trust me instead. Good habits and bad habits. And the faster that I learned to run to him first, it's not the way we, then the better off I am. It's not the way we usually do it, isn't it? Isn't it? We try everything that we can do first. And then when that doesn't work, then we go to God. In fact, we get everybody we know to go to God for us. But that's simply because we've already tried everything we knew how to do. Wouldn't it be better to just go to God first? To get that habit? Because if I go to him first, he can always say, okay, son, thank you for coming to me. Here's what I want you to do. Go out there and get a job, or, you know, go over here and do this. But I'm in that right place. It's the habit. It's the habit of allowing him to empower me in every situation. That's the habit I need to develop. And it's not the one we don't normally have those kinds of habits. We're not taught to. Men, when I see little kids, that from the time that they're born, they have the input of the truth of Jesus in them, and they start out their lives learning to depend on Jesus, I think, oh, thank you, Lord, they are going to be spared so much grief that would have come if they'd had to learn to trust in Jesus first when they were adults after doing it wrong their whole life. So I'm so grateful when I see our kids learning to trust in Jesus. So that's verse 10. Put on the full armor of God so that you can take your stand against the devil's schemes. A lot of commentaries that I've read, the emphasis in this sentence is on the phrase of God, the armor of God. Meaning, don't armor yourself, but take God's armor. But in Greek, that's not the emphasis in the sentence. The emphasis in the language is on the word full or whole. The language is very implicit and explicit, excuse me. The wording is you need to have all of it because you cannot stand against all of the schemes and deceits of the enemy unless you have all of what God has provided for you. You see the dependence thing again. We'll talk about that in a minute, but let's look at this first verb, put on the whole armor of God. Enduo is the Greek word, E-N-D-U-O, enduo. It's interesting because it's got a wide variety of uses. Some of them, well, they all apply to various situations, but it means to clothe yourself with. It means to envelop yourself in. And it also means to hide in, like running into a cave. Or what I was listening to last night. All those Psalms, 18, 36, 57, and 63, that use the phrase, I will dwell in the shadow of your wings. Every one of those that David wrote, he wrote when he was trapped and outnumbered by people that wanted to kill him. But he didn't see himself as trapped and outnumbered. He saw himself as enveloped in and hiding in God's arms and God's protection. Put on, enduo, clothe yourself. Hide in. I like that one. That's such a safe point of, that's a point, such a point of strength, but it's just not the usual sword fighter way, is it? Our way is I'm going to prove that I'm tough and I'm going to grab, you know, I'm going to grab my nunchucks and I'm going to grab my fighting stars and my stun grenades and I'm going to, you know, with the belt crisscrossed and I'm going to put a knife in my teeth and I'm going to charge the enemy. And God says, well, ain't going to work, buddy. You need more weapons than you've got. Yours are going to be inadequate. You need the weapons that I give you. The primary nature of the battle that we are in day by day is a spiritual battle, and fleshly weapons are going to be inadequate. They just are. Put on the full, that's the emphasis in the Greek text, the whole armor. By the way, he repeats this phrase down in verse 13. Obviously, it's important when it's repeated. The whole, all of it. The implication, like I said in the language, is very clear. You're going to need all of it. So put it on. I remember hearing Charles Stanley teach about this. He said when he was learning this habit, because he was raised like I was and other lot of you were, that you just get up and when you face a challenge, you go out and do it. And he said, I had to learn to not go in my own strength. And the way I learned it was by getting beat up a bunch of times. And then I realized, okay, I need to go in the strength of the Lord. And he said, I used to get up in the morning and first thing, he had this passage of the full armor of God that we'll look at next week. And each piece of armor, he said it was like it was there on my bedside valet. And I would get it up and I would put it on. I would consciously put that on so that I walked out armed. And he said, you know, it sounds silly, but he said, it taught me something. It created a good habit, even if it was a silly way to picture it. Put on the full or whole, all of it, all the armor of God. I'm not sure that I have the correct grammatical terminology, but one thing I learned from all of my good commentaries is that the phrase of God should not be minimized, because it means that the armor, its source and its origin, the fact that you have it is that it's been furnished by God, which I find thrilling. It's not about you being properly trained and having and honing finely honed skills. It's about God has given you everything that you need. It's learning to access that. 2 Peter 1:3, maybe one of the most important verses in the New Testament for Christians, says, God has given us everything we need for life and for godliness through our epinosis, our intimacy, our personal, intimate relationship with Him. And that's saying the exact same thing. Everything I need, He's furnished it when He gave me Himself. If we were to ask for a show of hands, which I won't do because it would be embarrassing, and I don't like to purposely embarrass people, but some of us got into our 50s or 60s before we began to even understand the rudiments of what this means. And sometimes we've been in church our whole lives or for a long time. But we just get, I love the way that you said it, that you just get in a bubble, and you get in this bubble, and the bummer is God's not in the bubble. It's just you. It's just you trying to nuke it out with things. We have others have said similar things, that there's this space that I get into, and God isn't part of it. And what Paul is talking about here in these foundational truths is one of the most important things to do, especially in the light of everything that we've looked at over the last month, is to learn to be empowered by God and to clothe myself with His might, and then to take advantage of everything He's furnished for me, which we'll look at next week in some detail. 2 Peter 1:3 is a good thing to write in there, right next to the put on the full armor of God, the full armor which has been furnished by God. Are you noticing now why we sang some of the songs we sang? I think one of the most powerful lyrics of the old mountain hymns to me is the middle of What a Friend We Have in Jesus, which says, oh, what peace we often forfeit. And there's the one that hits me between the eyes. Oh, what needless pain we bear. All because we don't carry everything to God in prayer. Oh, yeah, I know. No, seriously, really. It's why I had to write a note to myself. Never deal with anything without a conscious and deliberate fellowship with Jesus. That's what He's there for.